Welcome to the ninth episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jared. I'm with my co-host,
Eric Drysdale.
Today we have a special guest with us. It's my good friend, Corey Matthews. He's been a real estate agent in the Greater Toronto Area, focusing on buying investment properties for independent buyers, generally in the, would you say, around St. Catharines, I guess you've been focusing, Corey?
Yeah, the whole Niagara region and Hamilton.
We've asked them on here today because there's been a huge housing boom, and that's been a bit of a global phenomenon, but it seems to be especially robust here in Canada, where the median house price, I believe, has gone up by about a third year on year across Canada. And we wanted to bring Corey, because he's had some experience in the industry as a real estate agent and know-how on what's actually happening in the market, to maybe shed a bit more light on to what's going on. As you see it, what is like the current state of the market, and what is everybody really freaking out about, I guess?
In the current state of the market is, if you're to look at like kind of a bubble curve, it feels like we're in the moment of hysteria where people feel like they will never be able to buy a house. I mean, this feeling is the exact same thing that happened in 2017 when you saw prices rise about 35% from with what felt like January to May. It peaked in May 2017, and then we saw a correction through June, July, and August. What we're seeing there is this fear of missing out in the housing market, and people are trying to rush to get in. That, combined with all-time low interest rates, has just created like a perfect recipe for rising house prices. And then the other thing we're seeing as well, which, you know, normally, you know, in 2017, it really affected the GTA and specifically Toronto and then north of Toronto. Now what we're seeing is everywhere. In Ontario, up north in cottage country, we're seeing massive, massive growth. And the only explanation for that is the pandemic and people living in condos the size of shoeboxes and going, I need a backyard. I bought a dog to keep me company during the pandemic, and I want to be able to take him out in my backyard, or I need more space. Because if I have to work at home with my partner and they're working at home, we need more space because we're going to kill each other, right? So what you're seeing is you're seeing a huge rush out of the city. We've seen Niagara and St. Catharines go up. They haven't released the data yet, but because they don't do quarterly data, but from November to now, it's risen in some markets 20%, even as high as 30%.
So, I mean, 2017, there was like this short blip, prices rose, and then they came back down. Was there some kind of intervention that the government had to?
So 2017 specifically, what happened there was that was a lot more. We saw Markham, Richmond Hill, downtown Toronto, almost exactly when they put in the foreign buyers tax. Mm-hmm. That's when we saw a drop off there. And it was very much specific markets that got hit, in most cases, luxury. And we're seeing a similar thing happen now, where luxury prices are going up, and then also basically single family detached and townhouses and single family homes are all going up. And condos did trend down a bit and then now are resurging as people are looking at them as the cheapest asset class to get into.
Right. So that, yeah, that almost seems like, you know, as one asset class in this market seems to rise, then it almost spurs demand for others because everybody just seems to try and pile into the housing market.
Well, exactly. Like, and that's what we're seeing. And then we're also seeing, you know, things like FOMO from other people. So, okay, you bought, my friends were all buying into the housing market and they moved to St. Catharines or they moved to Hamilton. So now I'm going to go to Hamilton and start looking for a house. But when you go to look, it's $150,000 more expensive, which actually creates, arguably to me, a very dangerous market. I'm not really buying in this market. You know, we try to buy, from my investment perspective, my fiance and I try to buy at least one house a year if we can. But when the math works, right? And right now, the math just doesn't work.
The other thing then, like talking about this is, yeah, there's these similarities to 2017, but where is most of the demand coming from? Is there still just like people that are first-time home buyers that are now just taking this as their advantage? Like, are these real people who are like, so actually need these as housing, or is this like a lot of money's coming in from outside? Is it investment? I don't know.
We're in a very unique situation right now. So, I mean, Canada, I mean, if you want to go down like a conspiracy path, Canada has a lot of, we're very, very friendly to foreign investment, and we tend to have some money laundered here. Let's just put that out there. But that doesn't represent the entire demand in the market. What's pushing this demand right now and what we're seeing is we're seeing people that say bought a condo in 2015 or 2017 and they went up and they're selling it. They're taking the profits that they made and they're buying something outside the city that's bigger, but they're used to Toronto prices. So when they come down to St. Catharines or they go up to cottage country where my parents are, they go and they look and they go, oh, this house is $400,000. That's so cheap. When the locals are like, that house should have been $300,000. What did you do to, why did you price my property up? So we're seeing these people coming to markets that they've never seen before, never heard of before. And they're coming with realtors that don't necessarily have the data for that area or don't know the sales in that area. And they're looking at it and they're going, yeah, this does seem cheap. It's a 3-bedroom house for $450,000. And they're paying it. And that was in November, because now those same houses are $600,000. Right. Because what we've seen is a massive price up of these houses because people are jumping into the market and don't view it the same way as the locals do. Part of that is a city maturing, but a lot of that has to do with people from Toronto coming to outside cities and bidding the prices up a bit more because they don't feel is that overpriced when they're paying it when they compare it to Toronto. You know, value is in the eyes of the buyer.
But well, it's like, yeah, any asset is worth what you can sell it for.
Right. Yeah, but the problem is the biggest issue I think that's happening with this housing market right now is that our generation hasn't seen a housing correction of any magnitude for over 20 years. 2008, someone's going to argue, 2008, there was a correction. Yeah, there was a correction in Canada's housing market for 6 months. And then it went right back up to the way it was going up.
Right. Yeah, Canada did come out pretty unscathed from 2008. I don't have any figures here, but yeah, it was not like in the States, a lot of housing prices did not fully recover for years afterwards, but some Canada
cities,
was back.
Some cities are still recovering, right? And yeah. And that just didn't happen in Canada. And we didn't have the state, you know, and then people's argument to why our housing market is strong now is because we don't have subprime lending and we don't have balloon mortgage payments. Well, my argument would be we have different types of subprime lending. You know what I mean? I've been working in this industry for long enough. There's people that will offer second mortgages. There will be people that will offer 100% financing. You just get really, you get a nice way of saying it, but like you basically get bent over the table for the nine, you know, you're paying 9% probably for that second mortgage, right? And the other thing that other people are, banks are recommending and pushing their variable rate products. I don't know if you've noticed this, but we had the fixed rate mortgages were down to as low as 1.6. You could even get like 1.49, I think, at one point. Now those fixed rate mortgages are trending up to almost 2.25, in some banks, 2.5. And now what the banks are pushing is their variable rate mortgage. Now what happens with variable rates? Well, if Bank of Canada sees inflation happen to a point where they have to, where there's no choice, but they have to raise interest rates. I know Bank of Canada said, you know, they don't see raising rates for 2 or 3 years, but where you could see a similar thing that happened in the US happen in Canada is if most people are picking the cheaper interest rate with the variable and the overnight rate goes up, those people could get into serious trouble if their variable goes from 1.6 to say 2.5. Because 2.5% interest is still really cheap and really, really good. However, when you're at 1.5 and you've been approved for the payments at that, and now it's 2.5, it's almost doubled, yeah. Right? Which makes it harder for you to pay.
Yeah, it almost replicates the subprime mortgage crisis that was in the States, where just these rapidly increasing interest rates.
Yeah.
That was because of some kind of predatory contract where that was built into the agreement. But a similar thing, I guess, could be mimicked here if, you know, Bank of Canada interest rates have to rise, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm hearing from you, there's kind of like two worries. How exposed are these people who are buying these houses? Are they then going to have to, right? Like, are they taking on too much debt? And I think like the federal government, that's what they've kind of stepped up on, right?
No, I don't think so, Jared. I think the most recent announcement was that the stress test requirements, which basically looks at the percentage of your income that would go to finance a mortgage, has changed slightly.
And some lenders do have to follow those regulations and some don't, right? Like that's a thing. You can go to a secondary lender or a credit union that maybe doesn't have to follow those rules to get approved. people think when they think about the housing market crash, how many people do you think actually had to default for the housing market crash to happen in 2008 to happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it was at most 2% of mortgages default. Oh. That's not a big number. And Canada is a big country. Everybody thinks of Ontario, but people in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and stuff like that are having a pretty tough time right now as well with their economy. Mm-hmm. There's 10% unemployment across the country. The other thing that we're seeing as well that makes me worry, and this isn't supposed to be Debbie Downer, because I do love real estate as an asset class. I just have always chosen, you don't buy when everybody else is buying, buy when everybody else is selling. And this time, everybody's buying right now. It doesn't make a lot of sense to jump into this market. And the other thing that's happening right now that concerns me is there's a lot of middlemen and predatory buyers out there right now. There's lots and lots of signs up saying, we buy your house cash. We'll buy your house cash. Well, if you're a seller right now, why would you ever sell to somebody like that? You can put your house on the market and you'll get way higher. But their argument is, we'll save you real estate fees. We'll save you lawyer fees. Well, whenever somebody's doing that to you, they're really, in theory, actually just trying to convince you. They're trying to show you all the negatives so you don't do what you should do. Instead, yeah, take my offer. It'll be really simple and easy. And yeah, it'll be $50,000 under what you could get normally, but I'm a nice guy, so no problem, right? So we're seeing lots of that. And then what those people are doing is then flipping it before they even close on it. They're flipping it to somebody else for a profit.
So they're just for like, because I'm also a bit missing on that because I'm not invested in the real estate. But like, what are those? Like, why is it $50,000 less? And what are those things that you're missing? What are you leaving yourself exposed to when you're taking those kind of deals?
There's so many things I need to cover. So say you're the homeowner, Jared, right? And your house is a little bit weathered and not doing too great. And you don't really even know that the market's doing, you know the market's selling and stuff selling, but you don't really know too much about it. You're just kind of scared about COVID and you've been kind of not really paying attention. And then you get a letter in the mail that says, we'll buy your house cash, right? So these guys will come in, they'll buy your house, they'll do a firm offer. We'll buy any house, any condition, no problem. So Jared, no problem. We'll buy your house, even though it needs renovation. And then they'll try to swindle you down to as low a price as you're willing to accept, mm-hmm. while telling you that they're saving you money. They get your house for, say, $250,000 when your house is really worth $350,000. Then what they'll do, and they call it wholesaling, they'll wholesale your property. They'll go to investor groups because right now there's hundreds of real estate investor groups all around Southern Ontario. And they'll go to these places and they'll say, hey, I got a private off-market deal for you. And you're going to get it $50,000 under market. Meanwhile, they got it for $100,000 under market. They'll flip it to me and I'll buy it. There's still room for me to improve that property and turn into a rental property that I can keep. But at the end of the day, you're the one that gets screwed. I'm kind of getting screwed because I'm paying more than I should be. But overall, the seller's actually getting screwed in this scenario because they're not getting the highest they could in the market. There's lots of middlemen. I mean, think of them like a realtor without a real estate license and making a commission that's probably 2 or 3 times more than a normal commission
for some. By being able to like offer these like simplifying the process or whatever, and yeah, they're taking advantage of like naivety of these individuals, I guess.
And generally the people they go after are older, mm-hmm. retired, not having the money in the bank, right? Or a family where, say, the person that's living there is under power of attorney to their son and their son wants the money and wants an easy way out. So there's stuff like that going on the market. Then we also have a large amount of investors that heard about real estate from TikTok or from Instagram, and they see the numbers and they're like, wow, this seems easy. I'm going to make passive income. Let's go. I'm going to start investing in real estate. And they don't know how to run their numbers. And they're getting, and they have people that don't around them, right? There's their team, who's realtors and property managers, mortgage people, that are incentivized to make a commission that may, you know, I don't want to talk badly because I know there's a lot of realtors out there that are very honest, but there's also people that are just, you know, you want to buy a house, you don't know your numbers, sure, here's a house.
But like we said, 2008 was only 2%. So if it's just 2% of these bad actors.
Well, right? And that's what I mean, right? And then my other argument is that these people that are buying for the first time as landlords, if you don't understand, like when I run my investors through buying a property, I build in maintenance, I build in management, I build in insurance costs, everything that you're going to have to pay. And I also tell them, like, you're gonna have cash flow. However, put all that cash flow into an account, because you don't know when your furnace is going to go, when your roof is going to need a repair, right? Mm-hmm. You got to make sure, you got to be, it's also not a passive investment. You're running a small business and your customer is your tenant. So it's, you get a couple things. And the thing that I think is the biggest thing that could break the camel's back and screw people over is with 10% unemployment, people go, well, yeah, but the 10% is a lower income. They're probably not, you know, those jobs don't make up that much of the economy. What is it going to do? Well, they represent your tenant base. So what happens if your tenants start not being able to pay your mortgage anymore on your income property, and you ran your numbers so tight on that income property that there was no cash flow, so you have no extra built into the account? That's when you start seeing defaults within rental properties. And if that happens, then that's even bigger, because most people will scrape and fight and do anything they possibly can to make sure they don't go homeless. But if it's their rental property, they can just throw it away. If it's bought in their personal name, they can't, because that'll hurt their credit. But if it's in a company name, they'll just chalk it up to a bad mistake. That I think, you know, that's getting pretty extreme, but it's possible. And I mean, I think we could see some pretty bad repercussions to this market kind of getting away from people.
Right. Yeah. So it sounds like just if a bunch of these little things kind of come in, right, people start getting into the market when their margins are just that little bit too tight, because maybe they're getting in some backdoor way because they can get around this kind of those increased protections that the federal government had just kind of put in place, right? That stress test increase. And then say the interest rate goes up a little bit, say the unemployment continues to stay low, and you know, maybe CERB starts to run out or EI starts to run out for people, then you start to, I guess you get that squeeze. And that's what you're kind of concerned about, if I can kind of summarize a bit there.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I talk to my tenants every day, like, well, every month, right? And check in with them, and they're definitely feeling the squeeze, right? I mean, my tenants have all been paying rent and no issue, and most of them are still working. But yeah, like the people that own assets right now are doing very well. People that don't own assets are not doing very well at all. This has not been a fun time for people, right? And the other thing that's undeniable right now is we're seeing asset classes of all kinds go up, right? We're seeing cryptocurrencies obviously going off the charts. We're seeing stock markets at all times highs that rival the only other times you've seen these types of heights are 2001 and 1929. Which signals, okay, well, what happens if you run into a perfect storm where you have the stock market crash, which then takes people's, you know, people get worried about that and they don't have extra money to pull out if they lose their job because all their money was tied up in the stock market and now they can't make their mortgage payment. There's a lot of other X factors that could also topple this market. And that's what I'm saying, like, it almost feels like a perfect storm right now, because if I think a lot of people are really feeling like they missed out on something. So people are piling into different asset classes and they're scared of all kinds of different things, right? COVID's got people scared of hyperinflation. So people are looking at Bitcoin as a store of wealth. And they're also funneling all their money. Other people are funneling their money into real estate. And then other people funneling their money into the stock market. Now, at a certain point, people are taking on loans and taking on lines of credit to invest in these things too. And I mean, Warren Buffett says this all the time, but he's like, one of the biggest, most dangerous things is leverage in the market. It's great when the market's going up, but it's terrible when the market's going down. That's going to be a really big thing to watch as well.
Yeah. Right? Just to come back to the housing market, I mean, there's too many problems to have them all in one episode. But I guess I feel like I've got a good picture. Do you have more questions around like the state of the market that you wanted to go in?
For sure. So yeah, Corey, this has been like a breath of fresh air. It's really nice to hear someone from the industry not be a cheerleader or trying to boost their own product. I especially like your point about being a landlord, basically, and like the true economic cost of that. One thing I'll tell you, which is that I'm looking to buy a home with my partner right now, not because we have FOMO, but just literally because, you know, we moved in together last year. Like, we're just coincidentally at that time in our relationship where we're looking to buy a home, start thinking about raising a family. Unfortunately, it's coincided with a 30% year-on-year price increase.
I mean, that just kind of sucks timing-wise.
but you know what? I'll tell you. So before pre-COVID, I spent a couple weeks. So my training's in economics and statistics. I actually worked at the Bank of Canada for 2 years, and I was trying to construct a portfolio that would basically hedge against the housing market. So I came to this view that in some sense, when you have a housing prices that behave completely independently of the Canadian economy, and in terms I mean in like inflation or unemployment rates, like there's basically no connection anymore between key macroeconomic variables in Canada and what the house prices do. So when you have that, basically housing is almost like a foreign currency. It's like I need to pay my rent in US dollars and I have no control over what my US dollar income is going to be. So I said, you know, I'm going to try to construct a portfolio of as many Canadian housing assets as I can. And so I correlated seeing which REITs like most accurately track the Toronto house price index from Terranet or CREA. And I found like a bunch of stocks and it seemed like, okay, in theory, this should work. So I buy them all February, 1 month before COVID, right? COVID happens, all my REITs plunge. The housing market doesn't go anywhere. And then it starts going up. And it's because your point, which is that REITs derive their value from the ability of the tenants to pay. And so it dawned on me, I mean, you know, the stocks recovered, so it was okay, but like they haven't at all kept track with the housing market. And I realized there's actually no insurance policy that a renter can buy in Canada to hedge against the increased prices of housing or rent. And the only insurance policy is to literally buy a home. And it just seems like a huge market failure that there's actually no way to insure myself against what happens in the housing market, either going up or down. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Like, you mean a way to hedge against the housing market?
Yeah, exactly. Like, let's say I wanted to be a renter for the next 30 years of my life, right? But I want to basically ensure that my income doesn't, or that 60% of my income doesn't go to paying rent because housing prices keep going up at the rate they are. So I want to take out some insurance contract against future price increases so that if they do go up, I have more, I can basically pay against that future price increase. But that doesn't really seem to be an option if you're a renter in Canada, right?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, before COVID hit and before we moved down here and actually moved into one of the places we owned, the way I was hedging against it, because I've been renting in Toronto until August of last year when we moved down here. I was renting in Toronto for 7 years, and the way I hedged, I wasn't expecting the housing market in Toronto to go down, but the way I kind of offset the fact that I had to pay rent and couldn't afford to buy in that city was we bought in St. Catharines. I looked at the economics and was like, well, stuff has only gone up 2% a year here for the last decade. So that looks like a pretty safe, stable market. It doesn't look like it'll go down. It's just basically trended with inflation. So we bought down here. What I would say is you can't really short the Canadian housing market, but you could. If you were renting in another city, but you wanted to get into the housing market, find a market you think that is fairly valued and buy there and then rent that property out while continuing to rent where you live that is convenient.
Yeah, right? I mean, that makes sense. It's just too bad, right, that there's no options, right? I can't go into the stock market and buy an options, like get a put or a call against the Terranet housing price index in Canada.
Well, you can short REITs.
But then again, when the pandemic hit, housing prices went up and REITs went down, at least for the first like 6 months anyway.
Yeah. So if you had shorted the REIT, you would have done well.
Yeah. But in terms of like if my goal was to make money when the housing market went up and then lose money when it went down, if I was a renter.
Oh, yeah. I think the only real way you can do it and you're never going to get the thing is the reason returns on real estate are so much better than they are in the stock market is because you can leverage. A Canadian REIT that, say, has apartment buildings or even has a large amount of residential rental properties. Like, for example, Jared, you live in a building that I'm pretty sure is owned by a REIT. You could buy, to hedge against your rent, you could buy that REIT stock. But the difference is that when I go to buy a house down here, I can leverage it. I can probably put 5% down for the first one. The second one, I'll have to put 20% down, right? But I'm getting 5-to-1 leverage on my money. Whereas when Jared goes and buys the REIT that owns his building, he can only buy it 1-to-1. Maybe if he gets into a margin account, he could get maybe 2-to-1. You can't really get a better return. I mean, and that's why so many people have gotten into real estate. And I'm still a huge, you know, I think real estate is an amazing way to build wealth and an amazing way to make money. We're just in a point right now where I'm concerned because people are running very, very thin margins. It's the same that I'd be concerned with any business if profit and loss margins, but they didn't have any losses in there to account. You know, they didn't think that they would have any expenses. well, that's a concern, right? And that's how I feel like people are running their numbers. And then the other thing that I think is concerning before I go to the positive stuff is people are running their numbers to buy a house right now based off of a pandemic budget, which is no going to bars, no going out to concerts or food or dinner or entertainment. You're basically spending the least amount of money you'll ever really spend because you're locked inside and all you can really do is go to work, make money, come home. Maybe unless you're a huge online shopaholic, you're really not spending any money. So you have all this extra money, right? Like my sister and her husband too, right? They're looking and they're looking at their budget and they're like, oh, we have more money to spend and buy a house. But, you know, I told them, I was like, well, the other thing you have to account for in that budget is what life is going to look like after the pandemic. What was your budget before the pandemic? Because you are going to spend money on going out to eat when everything opens back up again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I even just my budget's way different because I don't even have to pay for any transportation at all. Like that saves me just in the bus pass living in Toronto. I mean, my budget's pretty paltry because I'm not a wealthy guy, but that just that bus pass every month, it's an extra $150 that I wouldn't have had otherwise. Right. You have a really good point there. And will people then be able to stay on these kind of new budgets that they've set themselves once things open up again? Or will they go back to their old spending habits and then wonder, oh, where the heck happened to all this money I was able to put aside before?
Just to kind of wrap it up. But the reason, I mean, the one thing that's justifying the house prices rising and fully making sense of it is lumber costs and building costs are up, right? So you're seeing plumbing costs are up about 30% since the pandemic started. Electrical costs are up 30%. Building costs in some ways are up 100 to 200%. Some things have tripled in price. The price of a 2x4 now $10, like, which is just wild. So you're looking at building a new house might cost you $20,000 to $40,000 more than what you paid before. That doesn't necessarily justify a 35% increase in house prices, but it definitely does justify an increase in house prices because you just can't build that same house for the same amount of money.
I think our listeners, the small number of them that there are probably pretty familiar with how good historically housing has been as an investment. So I don't know if we need to cover that too much. But what I did want to kind of pivot towards is like, are there steps that the government should be taking or could be taking in order to take some of that risk out of this? Or like, what do you think they could do to cool it? Because really, it seems like with this 30% increase, we need some kind of cooling. Either the prices need to kind of flatten for a long time or maybe a small dip. I don't know. I guess I don't have enough data to really know what would be preferable over that. But if it keeps a pace, obviously, we're just going to expose ourselves more and more and push us towards that kind of a crash. And I think that's what people want to avoid. What do you see as
steps? I think honestly, I think right now it's split. Like if you know, I'm on a group on Facebook called the Toronto Housing Market Crash. And if you ask anybody on there if they wanted the market to crash, I think every single person would say they want it to drop 100%.
Precipitously. Yeah. Well, but that's okay. So, but I guess that's the distinction between what I think the general public wants. Cause like, you know, and in my self-interest, if I was like, well, what's good for Jared? I've got a job in healthcare research. So like my job's not super tied to economic situation in the world right now. So if there was a housing market crash and then that allowed me to go and buy a house, that would be pretty great for me. But I can, you know, empathize with the general economy, I think, and say if the housing market crashes, people are going to feel a lot less wealthy and they're going to stop buying a whole ton of things. And that's going to be really bad for a whole ton of industrial sectors.
Well, it's even worse than that, right? I mean, you got to think how many people are involved in a purchase of a house? How many people make money off of a single purchase of a house? How much money does the government make off a single purchase of a house, right? Through land transfer tax, property taxes throughout the year. They're benefiting from the increased values as much as anyone else, right? The government is. I guess your question was, what can be done to fix it?
Well, we think that there is like a concern about buying right now. I don't know if that's a good state. Like, is it a good thing that like, if you buy, there's a risk that there's going to be a crash? I guess I don't think so.
Here's the thing, right? So for Eric's perspective, because I think it's a good one, is Eric's looking to get in for his own home. And if Eric gets in and he buys something that is, and he's not stretching to buy and he buys something that's within his budget, right? Which I think the government has done a decent job with doing, you know, by setting, you know, saving people from themselves, I guess, as lack of a better term, by doing stress tests and stuff like that. So stopping them from overspending. You know, if he stays within his budget, if the market crashes and he stays put, yeah, his house is down and yeah, his net worth is down or whatever. But as long as he can keep making those payments, he's fine. He's not going to be an economic disaster. He's not going to lose the house, right? Because he's still making his payments. He may not want to keep the house anymore because it may not be worth what he paid for it originally, but it could be, right? This is all just a scenario, right? So, you know, say you buy it and the market crashes 20%. Well, it's not hugely negative for you if you can hold on to your house. Now, where it becomes very negative is for people that bought that speculating that that asset would rise, right? This is the thing. A house didn't used to be seen as an asset. A house used to be seen as a place for you to, you know, live, right? So now that it's changed into an asset class and changed into an asset, the people that are going to be most worried about a housing market crash or should be most worried about it are the investors, because they're the ones that are buying these and speculating on real estate prices going up. And if the real estate market doesn't go up, then what are they going to do? Well, they're probably going to either going to cut their losses and sell it, or they'll have to sell it because they can't afford to keep it anymore. I think the biggest thing that the government should look at, and I mean, this is, investors are going to hate me for saying this, but there's a couple of things that the government should look at: limiting or finding a way to limit the amount of properties that, I mean, you can't do that though, because then that just takes away capitalism. But they should look at a way to disincentivize people from investing in, you know, own 100 properties. I know people that own 100 properties. You own 100 properties in a small town,
you own half the town.
A large portion of the real estate market.
Yeah.
Right. And you control a lot of the, you know, so there's that. I mean, the other thing that they're doing as well that I didn't really like that they announced was, and I'm, before I say this, I'm totally pro-immigration, but when you tell people that you're going to bring 1 million immigrants over the next 5 years, people aren't stupid. They look at that and go, well, I'm going to buy every real estate opportunity I possibly can because we're not developing at a rate to supply houses for 1 million new immigrants, right? So if Canada really wanted to fix their housing market problem, they either have to, and this is the thing, if they really wanted to actually make houses more affordable, they would force developers to stop building 4,000 square foot houses to get the most per square foot on a lot as possible so that they can sell that house for the most amount of money per square foot and reap the most benefit. They would then tell those developers, hey, what we need is affordable 3-bedroom houses that are 1,500 square feet for our population. We don't need massive mega mansions that people have to then spend $1.5, $2 million on. Because there is this missing kind of middle ground size of house, right? Everybody wants to put the biggest house they can on the smallest lot. They want to get as much square footage as they can so they can sell it for the most amount of money. There's regulations they can put in there, or what the government should do is just step back and not put any regulations in and just let it run as a free market. And if it crashes, it crashes. And if the people that speculate, you know, because I have no sympathy. Here's the thing, if you're speculating in a market and that market crashes, I have no sympathy for you. It's the same thing with if you speculate in the stock market with leverage money and the stock market crashes. It was your choice. And if it had boomed, you would have made a whole bunch of money and told everybody else they were idiots. And if it crashes, well, then everybody else has the same right to call you an idiot. Nowadays, nobody wants to take full consideration of their actions, and it's relatively frustrating. Nobody should be bailed out, in my opinion, and nobody should be saved. It's like you just either you let the free market run its course or you help everybody out. But this mixed bag that we're in just leaves everybody confused and pissed off, right? You have a large amount of people that have been saving and have been practicing very good financial literacy, yet they're kind of getting screwed because we're in a very low interest rate situation that we're in right now. And the savers didn't really benefit from that. The people that benefited from it were, you know, people that leveraged themselves up and bought every possible asset they could.
I totally agree with that, Corey. I think we've just learned though, like in the last, well, it's been more than 20 years, but the political economy of debt finance is that governments never let losses on debt finance be absorbed by the private sector. It always causes the bailout, right? Like the one exception was when you had like the tech boom and like, was that the 2000 or 2001 when like all those like dot com, yeah, dogs.com crashed. And it's like, yeah, maybe people, few people had margin accounts, but like, it was basically just loss of equity on the balance sheet. There was no basically government response. I think the Federal Reserve may have like lowered interest rates a few basis points, basically just let it happen. But every other debt crisis we've seen, from the Eurozone to subprime to basically any large systemically important institution or market, we know the government's just going to bail them out. I would prefer, probably prefer, to live in a world where there was no deposit insurance on banks. But because that's just not politically tenable, it means that we basically just have to regulate the banks heavily to prevent them from using that insurance to basically be profligate. And same thing with the housing market. I'm wondering, like, can I throw a couple policies at you and get your response to them?
Go for it.
Okay, here's a couple. So first, what if we removed the capital gains exemption on your primary residence as a way to benefit housing assets over other assets?
Yeah, so my thought on that, it makes sense, but also it doesn't. The problem we're having right now is a supply problem. If you tell people that when they sell their house, they're going to have to pay capital gains on it, they won't be as incentivized to sell their house. So then we'll have an even bigger supply issue because less people will sell their house. And what they'll do is they'll find other ways to access that capital through refinance. And you can refinance your house and you can pull out a good chunk of that equity you have in there without selling it and not pay any tax on that. In reality, what they should do, oh my God, I don't even want to say it because I don't want this rule to come into place because it's not, it would screw me. But
fair enough.
When I refinance money out of my property, right? Like, so I have a property that I bought for $200,000. It's now worth $400,000. I can refinance out probably about $100,000 relatively easily. I then take that $100,000 and I buy another property. Tax-free. No tax paid. If the government wanted to stop people from owning 12 properties, tax the refinance money. But every real estate investor is going to be like, Corey, what the fuck? Like that's how we make money. That's how we move and buy more properties. But yeah, like that would make a lot more sense than doing capital gain exemption on your permanent residence, because most people, the people that would be screwing is the general public. That wouldn't be screwing over the speculators. The speculators already pay their tax.
Or do they book it as capital gains? That means that their max marginal rate is only going to be at most 25%.
It depends. If the government sees you doing, say, like a flip every single year, they'll start kind of tracking you and then they'll start taxing you as income. But if you do like, say, one every 5 years or something, they're going to tax you like capital gains.
Got it.
And then the other thing is, even with this, right, because a lot of people are going, oh, well, you should put that capital gains in for the flippers that are, you know, staying in their house for a year and then selling it and not paying any capital gains. Well, yes, but the CRA is also smart enough that they are catching those people, right? You can only do that once or twice where you know, I buy a house, I renovate it, and I live in it for 12 months. So it's actually considered my permanent residence. So when I sell it, it doesn't have capital gains. But you can only do that maybe one or two times before the CRA starts getting wise and goes, no. No. Right. So.
That's good to hear that our tax agency is actually a bit clever. I didn't realize they had that level of sophistication. That's good to hear.
They're pretty sophisticated.
So, Jared, if you're okay, I'd just like to pivot, just because it's been mentioned a couple times now, the issues of supply and, you know, Corey.
Oh, yeah, no, I know you're going to bring this up. Yeah.
Yeah, Corey rightly pointed out that actually, like, if you do impose higher taxes on selling of homes, by definition, you're going to get less resales. I mean, by definition, if you believe in demand curves, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or supply curves. If you're going to do that, you need to basically shift the market. Because right now in Canada, it's been a few years since I've looked at the Canadian housing data, but when I was a housing economist, it was roughly like for every one new home sale, there was about 2.5 resales in Canada. So most of the housing market in any one year is basically the sale of existing assets as opposed to like agreements to buy homes when they're completed. And if we're going to basically use supply as a way to temper the market, we need complete new approaches and, frankly, even restricting the ability of what local municipalities can do when it comes to zoning. So we'll take the issue of Toronto. So in Toronto, half of the residential land is basically zoned single-family detached. So you can't build a duplex, a triplex, a fourplex. You can't build any of that on about half of the land of Toronto. And then the other half is going to have various limitations, Toronto's official plan that guides zoning policy says you have to maintain the character of existing neighborhoods. And when you put this all together, what you find is that since 1971, more than one third of Toronto neighborhoods have lost population in a city that has more than doubled its population. And so what you have are these, quote, stable, end quote, neighborhoods that are stable because you can't really build anything new there. And when the kids move out and maybe grandma dies, then you've only got one or two boomers left. And so you've seen this huge building of condos in 20% of the neighborhoods in Toronto, which have driven about 80% of all population growth. And it seems that, you know, to your point, Corey, you mentioned that the federal government makes immigration targets and then local cities get to decide how much housing is legally allowed to be built there. It just feels like there's a complete disconnect and this concern of like the scary developers or building highways through Greenwich Village, which motivated those NIMBY movements in the 1960s, maybe rightly at the time, are just completely out of place in a housing market that is just going off the rails. And Jared, if you want to comment on that too, that would be great.
You pretty much covered it, actually. Like, I've seen the data that you analyzed for the decrease in density for Toronto, and like, I agree with you. Like, if we don't have a free market for supply, then why do we expect that there can be a free market on the demand side and there not be these huge price increases like this? It seems like there's so much more liberty for people to buy and sell houses, but then there's no liberty for people to actually increase the number of housing units that are available.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. Is a huge issue. It's a massive issue. And the fact that isn't the number one thing that any politician is bringing up is wild to me, because it's just, I even see it here in St. Catharines, and we experienced it in Toronto. It's like, we've been debating for 5 years having laneway houses in Toronto. Like, how is that even a debate? Put them up. People need housing, right? Because then what you are left with is, if you don't allow it, people will find a way to do it without the right regulations. And they'll put in very dangerous apartments, like basement apartments in places where there shouldn't be. And people will rent them because they don't have anywhere else to go, right? The pandemic's a very unique situation where we're sitting at people leaving Toronto. So we're seeing rents actually decline for the first time, and actually supply for renting actually decreasing. But that will come back when the pendulum swings back towards the city and the pandemic's over. But yeah, I think that should be the number one thing on the government's mind when anybody asks them about affordable housing. Where is the development? Allow developers. And like I said, too, don't just allow developers to develop in different areas or open the green belt up further. No. Fine. There's plenty of land within the cities that can be redeveloped or can be developed into a strategic thing or a strategic housing complex. They just aren't letting that happen because there's so much red tape to cut through, and everybody's got it. And there's so many special interest groups that are like, oh, don't knock this building down. Yeah, it has rats in it and it's basically decrepit and falling over, but it meant something 100 years ago. And it's like, yes, I am definitely on the side of preserving old buildings. However, I'm more on the side of repurposing old buildings. So keep the facades, keep the outside structure. But if the inside isn't being used as anything and it's actually dangerous, then keep the facade, keep the history of the exterior, and build a building that actually makes sense and has purpose for the people living in the city, right?
And the one thing I think I just want to push back a little bit on is like, yeah, you characterize a bit of it as like, you know, Heritage Foundation type projects. I don't know if that's even really a significant percentage of that. I think a bigger problem isn't so much like, oh, we need to save this old church because it has part of our history. It's more like, we need to make sure that this entire neighborhood that's within walking distance from, you know, Yonge and King, or like, you know, Bay and King, is only like semi-detached housing, and that we cannot increase the density here because, you know, we raised our kids here and I'm 70 now, but no one else is going to move back here. But I don't want the neighborhood to change. I feel like that's such a larger effect. And there is like that, there's a bit of backlash where there's like, you know, those archaeologists that are trying to save one building in all of Toronto, and then everybody thinks that they're the ones that are raising the house prices. It's to me, it feels like it's more these neighborhoods.
It's, I don't know, all of it in theory.
Yeah, I mean, it's contributing a little bit, but
yeah.
Right. Yeah. if you're talking about 90% of all the restrictions on density is coming from these kind of broad regulations on what level of density you're actually allowed to build versus a couple of houses that are getting protected, then I feel mischaracterizing it a little bit.
It's definitely more the density, but there are a lot of buildings that are really in rough shape that are being protected, and it seems kind of strange. But yeah, overall, it's just increased density and allow people to increase density if they want to, right? No one's saying you need to sell your house to a developer, but allow people to be able to put up, you know, 5 or 6 story buildings, because that'll be able to house, say, 100 people versus like 5.
I live here in Forest Hill. I rent in one of the few apartment buildings that went up here in the 70s. You know, we are a half an hour away from the downtown core, and there are mansions on housing lots larger than the lot my apartment building is on. They could buy that mansion for the $4 million it probably is and put up an apartment building and sell it and make twice as much money, you know, sell it for a $10 million apartment building. But it's impossible because of municipal guidelines and this kind of NIMBYist culture, I guess. It feels like to me like there's a real problem there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing too, though, is that we're about to head into, like, when we get back from COVID, if anybody thought the highways getting into Toronto were bad before, they're going to be horrendous. And it's going to be because so many people that think they're working from home. And this is the other thing that I think is going to be very interesting to see what happens to these neighborhoods that a lot of Torontonians and other city people have moved to, the smaller communities. What happens? And I bet you there'll be some sort of like CBC news story where they're going to go, after the pandemic, what's happening to our small towns? And they're going to see this huge kind of collapse in a sense, because you're going to go from people buying up prices. Like, I'll take my parents' area as an example, right? So they're up near Lake Huron. Their average house price is above $650 now. And you used to be, like, up until like maybe 2 years ago, I sold my sister a property up there, and she bought for like $350. And her house would probably be that average house, right? Average house prices, I think, were around $350 back then to $400. And now they're $650. So then what happens to the people that are local when work from home stops? Because work from home for some companies will very much be a thing. But for a lot of companies, they're going to want, when this pandemic ends, which it will end eventually, people will be coming back to the office. You will see that, because they're going to want to get their community back. They're going to want to get their teams kind of back and seeing face to face. And I think people, as convenient as work from home is, like, I'm a people person. I am excited when we can get back to face to face meetings, as convenient as online meetings are, because I don't have to leave my house. But like, I really will be excited for when we can do face to face. And I think a lot of people will be heading back to the office. So what happens when you live 2 hours outside the city, or an hour and a half outside the city, and you thought you could work from home 3 days a week, but now your boss is saying you actually have to come in 4 days a week? Like, it would be terrible, right? So that's going to be interesting to see how those markets play out and see what happens there. The other thing that I was going to say with that is, by increasing density or without increasing density, what we're seeing is urban sprawl. And urban sprawl just is not an effective way to build up on a city, or build up on, say, the GTA, because we are going to have terrible traffic, and we're going to have, it's not efficient, right? What's more efficient would be to have high rises, or even, I mean, a lot of people don't like condos, right? It's kind of a
dirty word in Canada for some
reason. Yeah, it's just a lot of Canadians are like, you know, just think of themselves as a homeowner, right? But even if we do kind of some split type of developments that are townhouses, right? You're still getting a higher density than you would with a normal house. And your location is closer to the city, which allows for commuting to be easier.
Also, Jared, I did some fact checking. Both Forest Hill North and Forest Hill South had more people living there in 1971 than they did in 2016.
I'm not surprised.
Corey, can I throw two more policies ideas out? I'm just going to float these, and Jared also, if you want to add a response to it, that would be great. So, you know, in the same way that the Bank of Canada targets basically the interest rate in order to meet its inflation target, what if zoning boards in cities targeted their density regulations to meet like a sort of measure of either house price growth or like vacancy rates as a percentage, linking themselves to some target that matters for their local residents and then adjusting zoning laws in response to that.
Sorry, just so I fully understand that. So adjusting zoning laws based on demand to get into that area?
Based on like the metrics that they're observing at that time, right? So if Toronto's like, I can't remember, before the pandemic hit, like the vacancy rate in Toronto's rental units were less like 0.8 or something, just extremely low. And year-on-year price growth might have been like 10 or 12%. So they might have a target, which is that if price growth goes above 5% or if the vacancy rate goes below 2%, you know, we're going to open the spigots of supply to kind of adjust for that. Because I feel like what I'm trying to get at here is that we have some organizations like the Bank of Canada who have to basically make policy decisions based on some metric they've committed themselves to, in this case, the inflation rate. But cities don't seem to commit themselves to any targets when it comes to setting their zoning rules. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I think you're asking for something that is, I don't know if Canadian bureaucracy can achieve, but I just don't think they move fast enough, right? Like our zoning bylaws last changed in St. Catharines was 2013. And I was like, when are you going to change these zoning bylaws? They're like, oh, we just changed them. So you changed them in 2013. What are you talking about? And they're not even that friendly to development. And St. Catharines had already reached its borders. So the only thing they can do to help price growth is by increasing density, because you can't develop outside of St. Catharines' borders. We've already reached the borders with all of our houses, right? So the only way you can really increase supply of housing is by increasing density. It would be nice to see that. The problem is we don't live in a necessarily very efficiently governed country, right? You have the provincial government that's different and conservative, and you have a liberal federal government, and they're always trying to kind of like pull one over on each other. So they're not really working cooperatively. What would be nice is to see some policies come in from a federal level and a provincial level to the municipalities, or it goes to committee of adjustments and they get the final say for developers that want to increase density. But you also need the developers to come into these cities, because the thing is, things take time to go through the process to be built. So you're always kind of playing catch up. If I put an application to the city of St. Catharines now, it's going to take me 6 to 12 months to get it approved if it requires committee of adjustment, because it's not, because I want to build something that's not in the current zoning. 12 months.
That's wild.
So slow, right? So then you think of, okay, how long does it take for a condo developer to get approval on a site permit and then to be able to build the maximum number of stories? And then the other thing you have to put into account is that the condo developers too are incentivized by price. So if the price goes up, they may actually want to wait a little longer before they actually put the shovels in their ground and start selling off the units, because they think they might be able to make more money, which actually happened in Kitchener. One of the developers canceled the project, gave the deposits back to the people that bought them, and people thought the condo developer was folding, but actually what he was doing was he was repositioning himself to be able to sell those units for 20-30% higher than what he originally sold them for. So you have a lot of different cogs in the wheel. In a perfect world, yes, the municipalities would have the ability to see that their population's growth is going and to see that the vacancy rates are low. But I mean, everybody saw this coming. St. Catharines' population or vacancy rate was 1.8 in 2017. We've all been trending down. I mean, even small towns that don't have any business to have a low vacancy rate or should have high turnover and, you know, or should have high vacancy rates have low vacancy rates. Like most cities in Canada, I think if you look at the CMHC like rental guidelines, I don't think any city really has above 5% vacancy rate, like apart from maybe a very, very small city. But most of the major cities all have, if it's not below 2, it's below 3. And 2% vacancy rate basically represents turnover.
It doesn't. Well, yeah. And that's like, I mean, that's just more evidence on the pile of like supply is incredibly restricted.
Well, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that if you say, okay, Canada's been bringing in about 180,000 to 200,000 immigrants a year, depending on the year, but like that's been the average kind of for the last 5 years. Where are they going? Have we made 180,000 new units? And then, okay, fine, assuming that those people are families of four, so 200,000, you need to make 50,000 units that can hold four people. have you been making 50,000 units a year in Ontario? I mean, not consecutively, not every single year. So then why does the government feel like they can increase immigration when we are not increasing supply, and then are flabbergasted when they realize that the prices are going out of control because there's way too much demand?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry. I'm going to move to my second question, Jared, just because it's too perfect. So I was going to float it even more. I was going to call it the nuclear option for policy, which would maybe finally link the left and the right together, because it's something they both care about, which was that if you had it so that Canada's national immigration numbers tracked, say, the 3 or the 5 year average of housing starts plus some number. So this way you could, the conservatives would like it because, you know, you're building things, you're increasing GDP, it's good for business. The liberals would like it because that way they get the immigration numbers they want. But it means that you get to go to these neighborhoods like the Forest Hills and say, you know, if you're really pro-immigration, you really want Canada to be a home for refugees around the world, you're going to actually have to put some skin in the game here and build some houses. Because if you don't, we're going to have to reduce the number of permits that we issue every year.
I mean, here's the thing too, right? Listen, I want Canada to allow refugees to come into their country, for sure. However, if we're letting people come into this country who are coming from a country that was, you know, war-torn, yes, we're better than that. You know, like, our country is better than that for them. So they're, you know, they're benefiting. However, if they get here and they're really struggling to find a place to live, and then they end up homeless, or they end up, you know, falling through the cracks, is it really better for them? Right? Like why there needs to be a better plan in place to say, okay, we're going to bring in this many immigrants, or we're going to have this many people, you know, like, I understand Canada has an immigration policy because our population is declining because we don't have a huge birth rate. Now, bring in immigrants, yes, but make sure they have a place to live, because you're not helping anybody by bringing people in and then they can't afford to live in the city that they choose.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's not a problem. Canada is not too small. It's a problem that we're forcing on ourselves.
Yeah,
we are forcing this low density living in our major economic centers, the cities, shooting ourselves in the foot economically. And then, yeah, we are bad people for forcing people to live like this.
Yeah. Well, and the other argument too is, like, why are we structuring so that they come here and then everybody wants, you know, like, I always hear the realtors in Toronto touting, like, oh, wow, we get like 180,000 immigrants to Toronto or to Ontario. So Toronto housing prices are always going to be fine. It's like, why are they coming to Toronto? And, like, yes, I get it, because Toronto is the most multicultural. So then when they come to Toronto, they have somebody or a piece of their culture that they can relate to. Sure. But why aren't we kind of working on, you know, working together with other provinces to say, hey, there's great affordable real estate here. And there's lots of, you know, like, lots of room for you to create economic activity. Why don't you come to our country and go to Saskatoon, where it's cheaper and you can start a business, versus Toronto or Calgary or the East Coast? You know what I mean? Like, why don't we set it up for them to kind of win versus this kind of weird battle we have where everybody just wants to live in Toronto or Vancouver, where the prices are ridiculously priced? Let's find ways and do that by opening government offices in other countries, or sorry, other provinces, right? I mean, different things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for, like, let's make more jobs in these places that are not, yeah, Vancouver and Toronto, for sure. I guess I'm less on board when it's like we're starting to tell people where they can live. I wouldn't be in favor of that. If we're going to then say, you know, not enough people are living in Saskatoon, let's put some money there so that there are jobs there, so then people will choose to go and live there.
Exactly. Right. Incentivize it. So it's like, oh, this makes a lot of sense to go here. Not forcing them. Nobody wants to be forced to go somewhere. But
yeah. But we can have infrastructure investments. We can have, business tax incentives, whatever, right? There's lots of space in Saskatoon. There's a declining population. And I don't know. I don't actually know anything about Saskatoon. I don't want to turn off our Saskatoon viewers. I'm sorry. No, this is all incorrect. But yeah.
Random town. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Find somewhere that makes more sense for create opportunities in places other than Toronto and Vancouver, and you will see better growth, right? It just, because if you sandwich everybody into one spot, obviously we're going to run into this problem of affordability.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Eric? I see you.
Well, I think the one problem with this conversation is that we just agree too much with each other. So there's just too much agreement here. So Corey, we're at the point in our podcast now where we completely shift gears and we go to an underrated versus overrated section. So I'm just going to throw out one or two words at you, and we want to get your initial response, which is, do you think this thing is underrated, overrated, or you can say neutral or pass? Are you ready for this segment?
I'm ready.
All right. Chekhov.
Overrated.
Why?
like Chekhov, the actor.
Anton Chekhov, Cherry Orchard, man. The seagull.
Overrated. I never liked him.
Okay.
I have no further comment.
All right. Number two, Mississauga.
I'd say adequately rated because a lot of my friends are from Mississauga, so I don't want to talk shit. from a people perspective, love it. From a geographical perspective, it's like any other suburb, which I don't really love.
Got it. Moving on. Bay Windows.
Underrated.
Can you elaborate?
Bay Windows are amazing. They let light in. They just like create a very... Everybody wants one. Everybody
I agree. I just, I love the effect when you walk in a room with bay windows.
And there's nothing like a bay window with like a little sitting nook where you can sit and like have a little coffee, read a book. I mean, I've never done it, but it always looks nice in like stories.
The house price value just goes through the roof with those bay windows.
Through the roof. Oh, you have a little bench by your window? Damn.
All right. So this question is partly because I grew up in BC, so I find this a little bit puzzling, but cottage life.
Oh, my fiance is also from Burnaby, so Vancouver, or like BC. Cottage life is, it's nostalgic. That's the only way I could describe it to why everybody loves it so much. And everybody has a different, everybody has a different version, right? Like the Muskoka version, the fancy, fancy cottages is not what people like. Nostalgic to me, cottage life is like going to my grandpa's old shitty hunting cottage, right? And that was like the coolest. Just got to like run around and like you play games at night and during the day you just run around and be in the water. It's amazing.
Yeah, actually an interesting thing I just want to bring up is kind of unrelated. But yeah, in BC, I know like we had what would be in Ontario called a cottage that we called a cabin. And like I think out here, you know, your grandpa's place, that's not necessarily like the quintessential cottage. That would be just like a different house, right?
Yeah.
You're more like roughing it then, eh?
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, that's
nice.
Kind of what cottages were, right? Like cottages were just, you know, like a two bedroom kind of thing. And you'd like, cause it would, you know, you'd have like your friends up, maybe like kind of like a sleepover or something like that. And it just had a very like family, homey vibe that you kind of escaped the city. Mm-hmm. And that's your kind of worries. Like as soon as I go up to a cottage, it doesn't have to be mine. It could be like a friend's or a rental. It just feels like your worries just slip away. It's a feeling more than anything.
All right, next one for you. Cryptocurrencies.
Which one?
Well, the movement. I mean,
here's the thing. I think they're probably at this point, I still think they have a long way to go, but I feel like at this point they're probably overrated to some degree.
Is there one that you feel is underrated?
I mean, I personally like Ethereum. I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, given all the asset prices that have all gone up and everything going up and like GameStop going crazy and everybody just getting into like meme stocks and stuff like that is like, it all just feels very similar to a tulip bubble. And I'm not saying that Bitcoin doesn't serve a purpose or Ethereum doesn't serve a purpose, but there's like 1,000 different altcoins and they can all do well. It's like when the pot sector took off and everybody jumped into any single pot stock they could. And in reality, we all knew there was only going to be a few winners that ended up doing okay 5 years down the road, right? So it's the same thing, right? Like there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. Just invest strategically and don't put everything on black. You know what I mean? Like don't put everything you have on Bitcoin or everything you have on Dogecoin.
It sounds like sound advice.
Right. It's just being smart, right? Like, and the other thing too, I'd say is that like the people that really won on Bitcoin are the people that bought it at 10 cents or a dollar or even at $5,000, right? But if you're buying it now, you're buying it, you got to think, you know, is it going to go up 10% this year? Because you're not going to get a 10%, you're not going to get a 10 times return on Bitcoin, I don't think, at this point. Not in a year, you know, maybe a decade, 2 decades.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of today's podcast. Corey, we're so glad you could be our guest today. And thanks for providing such a stimulating conversation. I think we were just having so much fun. We just kind of went on for a little bit, but I hope the listeners found it as interesting as I did. And thank you for listening to the 9th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast.